quite natural to desire her. But he doesn't desire her for herself. He never speaks of her beauty, or her virtue, or her graces. Like many repressive people, he is himself repressed. When he has a fantasy of being married to Olivia, she plays actually very little role in the arrangement. He desires not love, but a vertiginous rise in social position. He wants to be Count Malvolio. Now, there's nothing wrong with that either, I think. Or certainly Shakespeare didn't think so. He himself rose socially. He managed to get a coat of arms for the Shakespeare family, to have them declared gentry. That was a rise from the origins of his parents. And he had the money to do it. He earned the money in his work in the theater in London. But Malvolio desires worldly position not because it makes possible comfort and grace and benevolence to others. He desires worldly position because it would give him power over other people. The power to rebuke and expel Toby and Andrew and Feste and Mariah. He's a tin pot tyrant. When he is deluded into believing that Olivia is in love with him, he expresses a feeling that none of the other lovers in this play ever express. A smug satisfaction in finding himself the object of love. All the other lovers give when they fall in love. He only takes. The best way to demonstrate this is to look at his fantasy. This is Malvolio daydreaming, unaware that he is overheard by the other characters, and I'll leave out their lines and just do this as a soliloquy in Act 2, Scene 5. To be Count Malvolio, having been 3 months married to her, sitting in my state. Now, a state is a raised chair with a canopy over it. He's going to look like a king when he's a count. Calling my officers around me in my branched velvet gown, having come from a daybed where I left Olivia sleeping. Now, that's very interesting. He's got a fantasy about marriage to her. But first he thinks of the chair, and then he thinks of the officers whom he'll summon. Then he thinks of his own clothes, and only then does Olivia come into the relationship, and she's lying on a daybed, apparently sexually exhausted by his exertions and demands of her. And then to have the humor of state, and after a demure travel of regard, telling them, I know my place, as I would they should do theirs. Now, that's just outrageous. You're having an enormous fantasy about getting out of your place, and in this fantasy you say, I know my place, and squash the officers. To ask for my kinsman, Toby. Oh, this is going to be the great delight of being a count. You don't have to call Cousin Toby Sir Toby anymore. You just call him my kinsman, Toby. 7 of my people, with an obedient start, make out for him. 7? He needs 7 people to go get one drunken old sot? I frown the while, and perchance wind up my watch, or play with some rich jewel. I assume he's playing with his steward's chain, and then he remembers he wouldn't be wearing the steward's chain anymore. He would be having something grander ornamenting his doublet. Toby approaches, curtsies there to me. I extend my hand to him thus, quenching my familiar smile with an austere regard of control. My goodness, when have we ever seen Malvolio smile, let alone quench it with an austere regard of control? He's got an austere regard of control all the time. One of the funny things about the delusion is that they make him smile all the time. The forged letter tells him to do so. That is the way he behaves. This is the thematic opposition. The theatrical result of this thematic opposition between the Puritan repressed daydreamer on the one hand and the festival drinkers on the other. The theatrical result are two of the funniest scenes in Western comedy. The scene when Malvolio actually picks up that letter and swallows its absurd commands whole and begins to delight that Olivia loves him. And the later scene where he follows out the commands of the letter to appear in yellow stockings and cross-gartered and be impudent to everybody in the household except Olivia. In these scenes, Sir Toby and Sir Andrew and Fabian and Feste and Mariah are all getting their revenge for particular threats and disservices that Malvolio has done them. We are told why each one has a motive to exact some kind of comic revenge upon him. And the result is a piece of precisely measured comic revenge. He had been dreaming of greatness to be Count Malvolio. He had imagined Toby curtsying to him. Well, at the end of the play, his bitter complaint to the Countess is that Toby has been given rule over him when he was thought to be mad. He asked the revelers in the midnight party scene, "My masters, are you mad? Are you out of your minds to be drinking and making noise at this late hour?" The revelers make him appear to be mad and put him in the dark house. He had spurned and criticized the fool, Feste, going so far as to suggest to Olivia that she get rid of him. "I don't see why my lady should be troubled with so barren a fool as this. It's not even funny." Well, the fool spurns him in the dark house. The whole revenge is exact and just. And the locking up of Malvolio alone in the dark house is a stage picture, a precise emblem of Malvolio's spiritual condition. He is locked in his own dark, isolated ego. And the fool tells him truly, "I say there is no darkness but ignorance, in which thou art more puzzled than the Egyptians in their fog." The ignorance of knowing no one but yourself, of not going forth of yourself. The contrast to the generosity of all the other lovers in the play. Having said that, I must pull back just a little. I've got to add and accept. Somewhere along this process, the comic revenge, funny as it is, begins to turn slightly sour. Not wholly sour, but Toby himself begins to worry if he will get in trouble with his cousin, the Countess, for bedeviling her steward in this way. And he's living off Olivia. He's got to be careful about that. And somewhere along the process, I don't know at what point, it may be a different point for every one of us, but somewhere along the process of what Malvolio goes through, we in the audience may be struck by the fact that Malvolio is genuinely suffering. For a sane man, and of course Malvolio really is sane, to be locked up in the loony bin and to have his pleas for help derided is, of course, a nightmare. The revenge upon Malvolio I described a moment ago as being exact and just. But exact justice may be something that none of us can endure. As Portia says in The Merchant of Venice, in the course of justice, none of us should see salvation. The pathos of Malvolio's position late in the play has earned attention in productions of the late 19th and the 20th centuries. The dark house scene has lent itself to anguished playing. The most famous modern version, perhaps, has been with the actor Michael Hordern. And in the production in which he played Malvolio, There was no structure on the stage to represent the Dark House. We didn't, in fact, see Hordern himself. The Dark House was a trap door in the stage floor. He was down under the stage floor. So that all the audience saw was his anguished hands as he reached up, begging the fool for help. Please, get me pen, ink, and paper, that I may write the Countess and get myself out of here. Don't mock me. And in fact, we didn't see him, but just saw the gesture calling for help was indeed moving. In the final scene, when Malvolio has been released and comes before all the other characters who have sorted out their various love problems and gotten properly matched up with each other, when he comes forth to make his complaint about how he has been abused, he does so with a kind of dignity. He still thinks that it is Olivia who is responsible for that letter that misled him so much. And he speaks to her. Tell me, in the modesty of honor, why have you given me such clear lights of favor? Bade me come smiling and cross-gartered to you? To put on yellow stockings and to frown upon Sir Toby and the lighter people? And acting this in an obedient hope, why you have suffered me to be imprisoned, kept in a dark house, visited by the priest, and made the most notorious Geckon gull that e'er invention played on. Tell me why. There is a dignity in that speech, and a pathos, and an emotional impression that is partly created by the way it is written. This is the only time that Malvolio speaks in blank verse. Everything else of his is written in ordinary prose. But he rises to the level of blank verse as he demands to know why he's been so notoriously abused. Then it is all explained, and Fabian in particular explains how they made fun of him, and they didn't mean any harm, and it would be a nice thing if we could all laugh about it and forget. You hurt us, we hurt you. Quits are even. Let us laugh about it instead of being angry about it. But Malvolio will not give up. He will not be reconciled. He refuses to recognize his own faults. He refuses to admit his deeds brought these revenges on. He refuses the peacemaking efforts of Fabian. And that leaves us with some bit of dissatisfaction. He exits from the final scene instead of joining the happiness there. He exits with a terrible line, "I'll be revenged on the whole pack of you." A line not only refusing reconciliation, but indicting people who haven't even had anything to do with this, because on stage at that time are, as well as the people who have put him in the dark house, Sebastian and Viola and the Duke, who have had nothing to do with it. We want this man to relax, to try for a more satisfactory connection with people. Why does he give himself over to such wholesale resentment? It would really be very comforting to forget all about Malvolio, to conclude merely that he deserves what he gets, which is fundamentally what I've been saying in this lecture, and then to dismiss him from further consideration so that we can thoroughly enjoy the end of the play. But we can't. The suffering, the isolation of his ego are there, even if it is his own choice to isolate himself. That is, the real vexation about Malvolio's stubbornness at the end is that he wounds our pleasure. This is a comedy. It ends in happiness, in the still, silent wonder of the marvelous recognition scene when Sebastian and Viola finally see each other and each knows that the twins are both alive. In the still, silent wonder of the recognition that fortune is benevolent, that salt waves have been fresh in love, that there is no quarrel to taint the condition of the present time, that each has found a spouse and all are happy. Malvolio injures our pleasure slightly. Not as much as Shylock does at the end of The Merchant of Venice. I'll come to that in a later lecture. But slightly. And by doing so, he anchors the play in real life. If the play were just lovers and benevolent fortune, it would be too sweet. A cotton candy confection. I don't mean to knock the love plot. I've said it's improbable, but I think that it contains truth, that the things it deals with are part of life, love and generosity. But of course, they're not all of life. And Shakespeare is a comprehensive writer. Comprehensiveness is one of his great virtues. He closes this comedy with predominant happiness, but reminds us that there are always some people who'd decline to join these supposedly universal celebrations of common humanity. Some Scrooges don't join the party at the end of the book. Malvolio is wrong by the values of the play, which are the values of love, warmth, forgiveness, and generosity. But he's true to himself, and his enclosed egoism is a part of life also. Some 15 years back, the distinguished British actor Sir Anthony Quayle visited a Shakespeare class I was teaching at Dartmouth. Since he has acted a great deal of Shakespeare, and for most of the 50s was the artistic director of the Shakespeare Festival at Stratford-on-Avon, he was able to share very generously with my students all sorts of stories about Shakespeare. Interpretations of particular scenes, parts he had played, work that he had done with fellow actors on Shakespeare. He was really extremely kind and gave us many perceptive comments and a wonderful stream of theatrical anecdotes. This went on for over half an hour until a student of mine brought up The Taming of the Shrew, which we had read several weeks earlier. At that point, this genial fountain shut up. Quayle declared The Shrew to be a hateful play and said, "Ask me about something else." And we had to clear our throats and collect ourselves and think quickly of another topic. Now, in fact, The Shrew has nearly always been a popular play, both in Shakespeare's texts and in any number of adaptations. There is, for example, another Elizabethan play called The Taming of a Shrew, that is so close to Shakespeare's in date that we don't know which is first, whether Shakespeare was ripping that one off or the anonymous author of A Shrew was ripping Shakespeare off. In that one, Kate has two younger sisters, so there are more suitors and the plot differs a bit, but there are many parallel scenes. In the 18th century, David Garrick wrote a short version of it called Catherine and Petruchio. In the 20th century, Cole Porter wrote a musical version of it called Kiss Me, Kate. But Anthony Quayle has hardly been alone in his dissent from the play. Lots of people have disliked it. And the play has caused considerable amount of argument and hard scholarly research from feminist scholars in the last 25 years. Feminist scholarship has mattered a lot in recent Shakespearean work, and they have worked a lot on this play. Now, at the end of the 20th century, it poses still two large problems, a problem of doctrine and a problem of action. The problem of doctrine is that it appears to preach male supremacy in marriage. The problem of action is that it appears to humiliate its spirited heroine by making her the victim of farce. In this lecture, I'll talk about the marriage. In the next one, I'll take up farce. As in other Shakespearean comedies, the action focuses on bringing together several couples, Kate and Petruchio, her sister Bianca and Lucentio, and in a small variation introduced very near the end, Hortensio marries a widow. But the way in which the story is handled is rather more realistic than is usually the case in Shakespearean comedy. Here, there are no shipwrecks on remote shores, no identical twins, no heroine wearing a male disguise as in Twelfth Night. There is no rushing off to dwell in a pastoral forest as in As You Like It, no mysterious lottery by which the heroine will find the right husband as in The Merchant of Venice. Instead, we are in a familiar bourgeois commercial society. In this case, it is the Italian city of Padua. And there is a wealthy gentleman, Baptista Minola, who has a problem that would be completely recognizable to the Elizabethan audience for whom Shakespeare was writing in the 1590s. He's trying to find suitable husbands for his two daughters. That's his job as a responsible father. In the propertied classes, that is, amongst the nobility, the gentry, the bourgeoisie of the towns and cities, marriage in the 1590s was very often a matter of arrangement, the parents arranging suitable matches for their children, an arrangement in which property, inheritance, family, a title, if there was one, were important constituents. Fathers were expected to provide a dowry for their daughters, a sum of money specified in the marriage contract, which would go to the husband and make the daughter a more desirable match. The prospective husband, or his father, in turn would also provide a sum of money. This sum was called the dower, or jointure, and it was meant to be set aside for taking care of the wife if the husband died first. It's widow money. Now, this kind of arrangement, drawing up marriage contracts on the basis of sums of money provided by their fathers, may seem strange and even offensive to our modern assumptions about marriage. Since Shakespeare's time, we've been through dozens of 19th century novels and seen dozens of 20th century plays and movies in which people who marry for rank or money are bound to be miserable. And fathers who force their children into matches that they don't like are cruel, heartless people. But it could be regarded, arranged marriage could be regarded, as quite a reasonable social practice. This is the way in which an adequate income was provided for a young couple. Young members of the propertied classes were not expected to go forth and earn salaries, as we expect our children to do now. Wealth lay chiefly in land. If wealth was earned by large-scale trade, the merchants tried to convert it to land or other property as soon as possible. And property passed by inheritance. Therefore, the source of wealth for most young persons lay in their family, not in taking up a career. Parents who failed to provide for their children, who left a daughter unbestowed or a son unendowed, would be criticized for parental neglect by the other relatives, by the neighbors, by the children themselves. These parents had not provided adequately for the economic future of their children. It would be exactly the same kind of criticism that we would give to a middle-class pair of parents now if they failed to provide a college education for their children. Since nowadays, a college degree is what you need in order to have economic comfort. Now, any social practice can be well or ill carried out by particular people. Individual 16th century fathers may have acted tyrannically in matching their offspring, just as nowadays particular offspring may choose badly in selecting their spouses. Generally, it was thought decent of the father to consult the wishes of the children, to give a daughter at least the right of refusal to a suitor she found repulsive. But since women were, by and large, expected to marry, it would take a strong-minded young woman to go on refusing possibility after possibility. She might get scared that she would never have a husband, and then what would become of her? Some parents seem to have favored older spouses for their daughters. this would have the advantage that the man in the match would have gone past his wild young years of adulthood. Indeed, his father might have died and he would have come into the inheritance, and therefore he would be a stable and prosperous citizen. So it was possible for a young woman in her 20s, and that was the usual age of marriage, mid-20s, marry a man of 35 or 40. Sometimes it happened that way just for biological reasons. Infant mortality was high. Women died in childbirth frequently, so that a man might be several times widowed before he got a wife who, in fact, gave him children and survived, before he established a family. Now, in the 1590s, in Shakespeare's England, arranged marriage was not the only courtship practice for the propertied families. Some preachers and moralists discouraged arranged marriage, considering it largely to be a manifestation of parental greed, likely to create unsuitable unions, incompatible marriages. And incompatible marriages would lead to jealousy and infidelity, and they automatically assumed that infidelity would lead to murder. Such moralists advised a greater attention to the preferences of the young people. Poets and other tellers of romantic tales elevated the personal affections of the young people to an absolute. The course of true love might not run smooth, but it should run. It should triumph eventually. So there were a number of social models available to a playwright in Shakespeare's time. The situation was a rich one for a playwright to exploit. You can get an interesting plot if the choices of the parents conflict with those of the children. Modern social historians have disputed just what percentage of marriages in the 1590s were governed by personal affection, what percentage by family considerations. But fortunately for us, we don't need to know what percentage it actually was. All we need to know is that both arrangements were possible. So you could get an interesting family like that of the Minolas. Baptista's problem lies in the unpopularity of his elder daughter. With the younger, Bianca, there's no trouble. She's attractive, apparently very meek. Men flock around her. The elder, Kate, is also attractive, but she's an ill-tempered shrew and nobody wants to court her. Under these circumstances, Baptista does a fair to middling job. He tries to even the odds between the two daughters by specifying that the elder must marry first, thereby creating pressure on those who want Bianca to find a husband or to help him find a husband for Kate. He also provides money for the dowries of the daughters, and educates them to make them more attractive. Of course, he doesn't really understand them, and he favors one of them unfairly, and his early insistence that the daughters really love the men that they marry, that everything depends on winning their love, just evaporates wordlessly when moneyed men actually turn up to court them. So I suppose, in a world where arranged marriages could happen, were common, Baptista earns the grade of B, perhaps, maybe B minus. The interesting complications occur with the younger generation. At the start, Petruchio, coming to Padua, clearly has in mind a marriage of the old arranged kind. I come to wive it wealthily in Padua, he says, a line that Cole Porter stole bodily from him and made the lead line of a song. He tries to seal the match with Kate's father even before he's met Kate. At the wedding in Act 3, when he's behaving with deliberate outrageousness, he announces a doctrine of male supremacy in marriage so extreme that it amounts to outright ownership. She is my goods, my chattels, my horse, my ox, my ass, my anything. And oddly enough, Kate eventually falls in with this. Although she's rebellious for most of the play, at the very end, she articulates at length the corresponding principle of female obedience to the husband. Wives are bound to serve, love, and obey. In the other plot, however, Bianca and Lucentio, they behave with romantic independence. Bianca makes her own choice of mate, disregarding entirely her father's auction of her to the highest bidder. She marries in secret, and not until the knot is securely tied do the young lovers try to get the approval of their fathers. Now, although in later comedies Shakespeare favors romantic young lovers over the authority of the family, here the marriage of Kate and Petruchio, although arranged in the first instance for property reasons and with parental authority, turns out to be the happier one. And in fact, Kate and Petruchio are the more interesting people, much more interesting than Bianca and Lucentio. So the situation seems a little paradoxical, and it's difficult to say that Shakespeare is making any judgment about whether romantic union or arranged matches are preferable. Once the marriages have been contracted, however, the play does seem to take a stand. At least it ends with that long speech of Kate's in which a wife declares obedience to her husband. And it is a long speech, 44 lines. A wife should serve, love, and obey. A wife owes duty to her husband, as a husband owes duty to a prince. And this duty is properly symbolized by the wife placing her hand beneath her husband's foot, a gesture that must occur on stage in that final scene. That is pretty uncompromising doctrine. And to many people in the late 20th century, it is quite an attractive doctrine. Many men are embarrassed to sit there and hear these words. Many women are angered by them. Now, it is the practice of literary critics and theatrical artists, when they confront something they dislike, to reinterpret it. For the past 50 years and more, critics and directors have regularly attempted to revise the plain doctrine of Kate's final speech under the all-saving name of irony, claiming that Kate doesn't mean what she says. There are various ways to do this. The Kate may do it crudely, simply by winking at the audience somewhere during the speech. Or she can do it elegantly. There was a famous production in England with a great actress, Edith Evans, who played Kate as if Kate were the heroine of a high comedy, something by Congreve or Oscar Wilde. Very artificial and elegant. And by the extreme stylization with which she delivered the speech, made it clear, this is just a social ritual that I'm going through. I have to satisfy the men by saying these silly things. I don't mean a word of it. Lately, I've seen a new addition to this repertoire of ways of evading the final speech, a postmodern way of doing it. It was a shrew set in the American Wild West, and Kate delivered the final speech while holding the entire wedding party at gunpoint. That's what's postmodern, the total cognitive dissonance between words about obedience and those six shooters. Now, this can be done, as I say. You can ironize it. I don't think it works very well. With the winking or any other form of deceit, it seems to me to turn Kate into a sly sort of person. And what we had liked about Kate was her openness, as opposed to her sister's slyness. More largely, I think these methods are simply cheating. You can subvert any passage in Shakespeare by reading against the lines or contradicting it with a gesture. It's a familiar form of theatrical humor. It's great fun if you do it at a cast party. When you're actually doing a production and you want to suppose that someone is lying or deceiving someone else, you've got to find some basis in the text for that supposition. Shakespeare's liars and deceivers regularly alert the audience to their little plots. And if you look in the text for such basis, I don't think you'll find it. In the final speech, you will find a few lines, individual lines, that look ironical. For example, that business about Kate saying that a husband commits his body by painful labor at sea and land to the care of the wife. Well, the Petruccios I've seen all have looked slightly startled at the phrase painful labor. And rightly so. Petruccio's a country gentleman. He doesn't dig the ditches. He may manage the estate, but he doesn't dig the ditches. There may be local ironies like that. But a 44-line irony? That seems to me a bit much. In any case, verbal irony is far less important in drama than irony of event. When Shakespeare wants to set up a long doctrinal speech that will somehow be examined, ironized, contradicted, or at least qualified, he puts it early in the play. That's the case with the Divine Right speeches in Richard II and with Ulysses' speech on degree in Troilus and Cressida, both of which I'll talk about later in this course. But Kate's speech comes at the very end of the play, when nothing else can contradict it. The play ends with Kate asserting her belief that she should obey. Now, Shakespeare, is not as anti-feminist as he could be. The sources are much more violent in the way that Kate herself is treated, and Kate's profession of obedience could be stronger than the way Shakespeare wrote it. That anonymous taming of a shrew that I mentioned earlier has Kate swear obedience because Eve betrayed Adam in the Garden of Eden. She's the crooked rib. She's the source of evil. She should be ruled by her husband. Shakespeare doesn't have that theological justification for obedience of wives. Instead, his Kate talks about a political arrangement. Husband and wife have distinctive roles in a cooperative and companionate union. But however much we go into this, and we have gone into it, Shakespearean scholarship has gone into it a lot in the last quarter century, I think it's impossible to turn Shakespeare into a modern feminist. The assumptions of his time were not egalitarian. They were hierarchical. St. Paul explicitly endorsed the authority of husbands, and it would have been hard for people who believed in the literal inspiration of the Bible to directly fly against that. How the authority should be exerted is another question, but that the authority should be there is the assertion with which Kate closes the play. And is the case generally when such matters are handled in our older literature? There's a great marriage debate in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Who should have the mastery in marriage? The wife of Bath has it over five husbands. Patient Griselda yields it, even though her husband treats her in what seems to us a horrible fashion. But no one ever suggests abolishing the mastery, saying that the matter should be equal. Someone's got to be in charge. One either accepts this, or one rewrites the play, or one leaves it on the shelf. The Taming of the Shrew thus furnishes a good way in which a good example of the ways in which old plays can be instructive to us. If you don't try to rewrite it, if you accept it as it is, you'll find out a lot about the past. You think beyond the assumptions that you take for granted in the present. People did not always act as we would like them to do now. Why should they? We don't act the way they would like us to have done when they were thinking several centuries ago. Why should the living tyrannize over the dead any more than we want the dead to tyrannize over the living? The past is, in fact, a great reservoir for us all. It is useful to know that lives were organized in different ways, that we need not be trapped in the customs that happen to prevail at any given time. If we know that, we may be encouraged to forge new ways of coping with problems that seem to recur. by combining elements of the present with elements of the past with innovation. There is more to be said about how Shakespeare handles Petruchio's taming of Kate, and in particular how Kate can believably arrive at the final speech. I must postpone talking about that until the second lecture because I have to develop another line of approach first. But in what remains to me of this lecture, I want to tell you about one production in which Kate said the final speech, meaning it totally, accepting the doctrine that it preaches. And it worked unexpectedly well. I was really surprised. I didn't know this was going to happen. I had heard nothing about the details of the production before I went to the theater. This happened at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge last winter, January of 98. And the director was a distinguished director named André Serban. Kate's manner in delivering the final speech was quite different from the way that she had played earlier scenes. Hitherto, she had been quick, loud, assertive, spontaneous. In this case, she spoke slowly. She spoke uncertainly. She was thinking out what she was saying, discovering it for the first time. Thy husband is thy Lord, thy life, thy keeper, thy head, thy sovereign, one that cares for thee and for thy maintenance, commits his body by painful labor, both by sea and land, whilst thou liest warm at home, secure and safe, and craves no other tribute at thy hands but love, fair looks, and true obedience. I am ashamed that women are so simple to offer war when they should kneel for peace, to seek for rule, supremacy, and sway, when they are bound to serve, love, and obey. This slow, thoughtful delivery meant that she was really thinking out the words. And the pause after serve, love, and obey, one heard, or could hear, if you know the source, the echo. The source is the marriage rite in the Book of Common Prayer, where you swear to serve, love, and obey. It was extraordinarily moving to watch a person arrive at this new set of convictions, something that was unexpectedly true for her, whether or not I personally agreed with it. I was watching someone's mind change and find a secure resting place in a doctrine that made sense to her. Then something else happened. This discovery of hers was placed in a frame. The Taming of the Shrew is, as a matter of fact, a framed play. It opens with a couple of scenes concerning a drunken tinker called Christopher Sly, who's accosted by an anonymous lord who picks him up. He's been thrown out of a tavern and takes him home and decides to have a practical joke. This drunken beggar tinker will wake up from his drunken stupor and discover that he's really a lord himself, that he's been out of his mind for some years. And doctors are taking care of him, and he is going to be restored to health and wealth and wisdom. And part of the health treatment is that he be shown a merry play, because comedy is health-giving. And the play, put on by the Lord's own company of players, is The Taming of the Shrew. Now, as a matter of fact, we never get the end of this frame. In Shakespeare's The Taming of the Shrew, it just doesn't appear in the folio text at the end. We never go back to the tinker and the lord. But André Serban, in this production I'm talking about, invented an extended wordless action to replace the loss. The actors came forth in their ordinary clothes, full of good cheer and warmth toward each other, the kind of enthusiasm that actors always have when they've given a performance that has been well received, when they feel satisfied with their work. And in the hugging, something odd about the pairing was very noticeable. That Kate was hugging the actor playing Lucentio, and Bianca was hugging the actor playing Petruchio. The casting apparently had switched the real-life relationships that were going on offstage. And they certainly did hug, embrace, kiss, fondle in a very thorough way. But then they switched, and Kate embraced Petruchio, and Bianca embraced Lucentio. And you thought, okay, the casting is in accord with the offstage relationships that are happening. Then they switched once more, and it was the two guys who went hand in hand off one way, and the two women who went off arms around each other in the other direction. It was, in fact, a gay male couple and a lesbian couple. It was perfectly charming. The play preaches a heterosexual union with female submission, and it did so quite sincerely and movingly. Then this wordless epilogue added, quite simply, that's not the only kind of relationship there is. Other kinds of relationship seem to work too. Serban had added, in other words, to Shakespeare. This is an early Shakespeare play. Shakespeare is not full of quite as much abundance yet as he later will have. Serban is adding to that abundance now. The Taming of the Shrew is an early comedy of Shakespeare's, probably the second or the third. I put Twelfth Night before it in this course, only for pedagogical reasons, because Twelfth Night so clearly demonstrates Shakespeare's characteristic comic structure, the way he developed his leading comic theme of romantic love. But The Shrew actually comes 8, possibly even 10 years before Twelfth Night. And as I've suggested in the last lecture, The Shrew does not have all the variety that Shakespeare later developed. But The Shrew does display an adventurous young Shakespeare trying out new things that other people hadn't tried. The play is fundamentally a farce, but it combines farce with a strain of romance in a way worth exploring if we wish to understand the richness of the young Shakespeare's talent. In the romantic thread of the play, Kate discovers her inward self and comes into a loving relationship with her husband. This can be quite moving on the stage. But the bulk of the action is certainly farcical. Tranio, the servant of Lucentio, who is, as a matter of fact, is the second largest part in the play. Tranio exemplifies the trickery and disguise that Renaissance farce inherited from ancient Roman comedy. Grimio, the elderly suitor to Bianca, is the stock old man, the pantaloon, out of the Italian Commedia dell'arte. Petruchio and his servants display the physical knockabout, the slapstick, that occurs in farce of all ages. He is introduced beating his servant Grumio. He carries Kate bodily off out of her own wedding reception. Food and water are tossed around at Petruchio's country house. The clothes that are made for for Kate are abused. The tailor himself is abused. The verbal wit of the play is often farcical. Compared to the lyrical strain of speeches in later Shakespearean comedies like Twelfth Night or As You Like It, the wit of The Taming of the Shrew comes near wisecracking. Even the names are jokes. Although I only realized it recently, Grumio isn't an Italian name at all. It's simply the English groom. He's Petruchio's servant, with an Italian ending tacked onto it. The funny speeches in this play are one-liner exchanges, as in the courtship scene between Kate and Petruchio, or grotesque catalogs, such as Biondello's list of the diseases from which Petruchio's horse suffers, or accounts of physical roughhouse, such as Grumio's story of the horse that fell on him in the mud. And actors and directors, of course, add to the farcical element. There are not many stage directions in this play. There are not many stage directions in all of Shakespeare. But actors and directors respond to the obvious competitiveness within the script by inventing farcical routines that go with that script. Now, all this farce has distressed some thoughtful people. I've been collecting descriptions of farce for a number of years, mostly in connection with this particular play, but also from other places. I've written an article on this particular play. That's how this started. I was looking around for people to define, or at least describe, farce. And I found farce described as unnatural, rigid, depersonalizing, mechanical, inhuman. This is in work from scholars of repute. Farce may be amusing for a careless evening in the theater, but it isn't real. We don't take it seriously. That's the keynote of the descriptions I have accumulated. The use of the negative terms, unnatural, depersonalizing. Farce is described in terms of what it isn't. Or it's diminished. It's called something small. We say the thing is just a farce. As if it were easy to write a good farce. Perhaps I can sum this up best if I quote from an article from a scholar I very much respect, Robert B. Heilman, who wrote an essay on The Shrew that moved me into response. According to Heilman, farce deals with limited personality that acts and responds in a mechanical way and hence moves toward a given end with a perfection not likely if all the elements of human nature were really at work. Or another quote, those who have this personality are not really hurt, do not think much, and are not much troubled by scruples. They lack, largely or totally, the physical, emotional, intellectual, and moral sensitivity that we think of as normal. Farce simplifies life by a selective anesthetizing of the whole person. Now, each of these sentences is couched in negatives or privatives. Limit, without, not, lack, simplify, anesthetize. And it seems to me very strange. No work of art can contain all the possibilities of life. All works of art have to simplify to some extent by selection and emphasis. One could describe any genre this way and thus make it sound unattractive to those of us who are interested in doing serious justice to the possibilities of human character. What would happen if tragedy were described in this fashion? Tragedy concerns persons unnaturally ready to rush to extremes. They do not pause to reflect. See King Lear. Reflecting, they do so faultily. See Othello. By a selective anesthetizing of the whole person, they lack a sense of humor or balance. Macbeth could certainly do with a sense of humor about his problems. They will not sit down.